Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Are you in your element at work? Just for a moment, let your focus wander from the social status your job might bring or the income it provides. Think about the work itself. Are you really good at it? And more importantly, does it make you happy to perform the tasks required? How different would your life be if you could answer an unqualified yes to both of those questions? My guest today is concerned that too few of us could even imagine it, and that has plunged us into a crisis of creativity that threatens our future potential as individuals and as a society. Dr. Ken Robinson is a specialist in the development of human potential. He consults with businesses, schools, and nonprofit organizations around the world. His latest book is called The Element: How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. Ken, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
What does it mean to be in one's element?
Well, I think it means two things, really. One is that you have a natural feel for the thing that you're doing, you know, a natural aptitude for it. And I think we all find that sometimes, that we do something and we just know what it is, and you know, we feel we're comfortable with it. I mean, years ago, I remember I was born in 1950, and I worked out recently that I was given a guitar as a teenager at around the same time Eric Clapton got his first guitar. You know, it worked out better for Eric, really, you know, because he obviously knew what this was. I was blowing into mine. So part of it is that, being able to do it and feeling that you know what it is. But that's really not enough. Because I think all sorts of people do things they can do and they're quite good at, maybe very good at them, but they don't really enjoy it. I know lots of people in that position who are doing things they're good at, and they do them because they're good at it, not because they enjoy doing it. So to be in your element, you also have to love it. You have to have a passion for it. And that, to me, is the golden spot, you know, where you're doing something you love that you're also good at. You have an aptitude and a passion. And as somebody once said, when that happens, you never really work again.
Yeah, it's all fun after that.
Yeah.
Well, and beyond even those two things, you talk about needing the right attitude. What kind of self-perception does the element require?
Well, I think that very often there are genuine obstacles to people finding this thing. And it's not just one thing. It can be a number of different areas in which people feel that they're in their element. It can be attitudes of friends. I have a chapter in the book called What Will They Think? You know, when people feel that they would do this, but there'd be a lot of disapproval or skepticism, maybe friends or family or people at work. There's often a lot of self-doubt, you know. I mean, there isn't time for me to do this anymore, or it won't work, you know. There's no point in me trying it. There are often cultural constraints of various sorts. I think one of the biggest, and I talk about it quite a bit in the book, is education. I do think that in all sorts of ways, our current systems of education almost routinely steer people away from their natural talents.
Schools are set up to sort of value certain kinds of critical thinking as opposed to more imaginative thinking.
I think that is true. But it's true in several ways. One is that in most school systems around the world, I mean, I'm from the UK, you can probably tell. I live in Los Angeles now. I have done for 8 years, but I'm not actually a native Angeleno. I moved there 8 years ago from the UK, and I've done a lot of work with education systems around the world, and I'm now based here. What often strikes me is that there is a very similar hierarchy of subjects in schools. I mean, you know what it is. You get math and science and languages at the top. And they're very important. I mean, don't mistake me. I'm not saying they're not important. They are. But then further down, you get social studies. And right at the bottom, you get the arts. Most people who might be listening to this program who are in their 40s or over probably remember when they were at school having good arts programs. You know, they were doing art and music. They're probably orchestras and bands and theater productions and so on. Many schools don't have those anymore. Many children never get exposed to them. So one of the ways I think it happens is that there's a hierarchy of subjects which privileges certain types of thinking over others, certain sorts of ability. And the other is this culture of standardized testing, which I think is suppressing really vital abilities of creative thinking across the whole country.
Dr. Ken Robinson is my guest. He's a specialist in the development of human potential. His book is called The Element: How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. You write about this experience of having suffered polio as a child, which pretty much shut the door on any serious athletic prospects that you might have had. but today you say that it actually opened as many doors for you as it closed. Will you talk about that?
Well, yes, I was born in 1950 in Liverpool, in England. I'm one of seven children. And we lived right next door to one of the main soccer grounds. I mean, I call it football, but one of the main soccer grounds in the UK for a company, a club called Everton. And, you know, it was the dream of most, certainly most fathers in that area, that one of their kids would play for the team. And until I was four, it was looked very likely to be me. I was very strong, very athletic. And then in 1954, I'm sure some of the people listening to this will remember, there were these great polio epidemics across Europe and America. And I caught it at the age of four. I was in hospital for almost a year. I was totally paralyzed to start with, but then it started to recede. So what it left me with as a child was a weakness in one leg and the other leg not working much at all. So I wear a brace now. Well, you know, I think my parents were brilliant because for a lot of people, that could have just been the end of the road in some respects. But my parents were devastated. But they also understood that, you know, since a career in soccer was ruled out, I mean, actually, the way the team's performing now, it may not be ruled out, but you know, they may be calling on me any time. But from, you know, that I had to do something else. I had to really concentrate particularly on my education. And they really, not in a bad way, but put me under pressure to do that. And I was a bit resistant to it because this was Liverpool in the 50s and 60s. You know, rock music was getting off the ground. The Beatles were playing down the street. And my brother was in a band, you know, but they were kind, but, you know, persistent. And I did that. And what I eventually found was I had all these other abilities that I probably would have ignored otherwise, you know. I write a lot now. I publish widely. I travel the world. I work with companies and organizations. I've spent my life in and around the area of arts and creativity and innovation. And I think my life has been, in some ways, probably more fulfilling for me than it might have been if I'd got a jobbing spot in the local football team.
Do you think that you are just wired to view things from an optimistic point of view?
From a what point? An optimistic
point of view?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, obviously that's helpful in being able to assess your life in the way it's turned out.
Well, it is. I think optimism, you know, it has a bit of a ring sometimes of being a bit naive. You know, how can you be so optimistic in these situations? But, you know, there are, you make choices in the way you look at things. And yes, I mean, I think from an early age, I mean, truthfully, I think if this had happened to me later in my life, you know, it would have had a different effect on me. My father, for example, who was a wonderful man, who was devastated when I got polio, 5 years later had an industrial accident and broke his neck at the age of 45. So he was paralyzed the rest of his life. He was a quadriplegic. He was much more disabled than I ever was. And this happened to him in the middle of his life with a family of seven children, you know. So for him, he was the most remarkable man to have coped with that in the way he did. My mother, too. I have unending respect for them. But I don't think that about me. I mean, I was four. You know, what do you know it for? You mean, you grow up with these things. You do it. You get on. I went to a special school for 5 years, and I was surrounded by people with cerebral palsy, hydrocephalus, asthma, you know, weak heart valves, all kinds of things. I was so joking. I was speaking at a special needs conference recently. I said, you know, our classroom was like the barroom scene out of Star Wars. You know, but you don't see that. You know, you don't see people's disabilities. I didn't think, well, I'm not going to hang out with him. You know, he's got hydrocephalus. You know, you hang out with people if they're interesting. And I think it is a part of my worldview, this, is that if you grow up with any kind of disability, what you get used to is not people with other disabilities seeing you in terms of your disability, but other people define you through the disability. And if you have a disability, you don't define yourself by it. So a lot of my work has been in the air as well, as it happens, of promoting different ways of thinking in special education. Because I think we focus too much on what we see as the disability and not enough on what we should be looking at, which is the real abilities people have despite the disability.
Well, and in sort of a related section, in the book you write about not believing in luck in the way that some people do, and you have some fascinating scientific evidence that seems to prove that the way we see our lives has as much to do with how we fare as the specific events of our lives.
I think that's unquestionably true, you know, that it's not what happens to you in your life, it's what you make of what happens to you. The book is full of stories of people who pressed on and decided to follow their instinct about something despite often quite severe odds. And yes, there is some research we quote there from a book called the whole program of research on the nature of luck. What often strikes me, Chris, is this, that people who are doing the thing they love to do, you often hear it when you see people, hear people being interviewed about the things they love to do. They'll very often say, of course, I've been very lucky. And conversely, you'll find people who feel trapped in their lives often saying how unlucky they've been. But, you know, often people who are doing the thing they love to had all kinds of adversities to deal with. And that really led me to just question this idea of luck, because as soon as you say it's all about luck, you present yourself as a victim of circumstance. You know, I had no alternative. What could I do? And the fact is that very often other doors open. I mean, like, I'm not relating this to me, but, you know, the fact that my career as a football player shut down opened up some other doors. You know, my father didn't cease to be an important and vibrant man despite being a quadriplegic. In fact, he became an inspiration to the rest of the family and everybody who ever met him. So the luck thing is important. There are two things about this. One is that obviously random things seem to happen to people. And so luck has that kind of sense of serendipity. But what all the research shows is that people who think of themselves as lucky aren't defined by the random things that happen to them, but what they do about them. So there's some research that we quote in there of a psychologist called Wiseman, who was interested in these distinctions, and he set up an experimental situation. Somebody, he'd arranged to meet people who said they were lucky in a cafe, and other people who were unlucky, and he staged this event, so people turned up one at a time, and he'd actually arranged the cafe, so there was somebody sitting at the table, there was nobody else apart from the tender at the bar, and he put a $20 note on the floor. Almost always, the people who said they were lucky spotted the money and picked it up, waited, and then started talking to the other person at the other table, asked if anybody wanted the money, and when they didn't, they felt it was okay to have it, or they gave it to the barman. He tells the example of this other lady who said she was unlucky, who turned up, didn't notice the money, stepped over it, sat in the corner on her own for 20 minutes and left. You know, in other words, the setup was exactly the same for them both. But one group of people made something of the situation and the other people became depressed by it. So I don't think it's so much about making your own luck, but it is what you make of the circumstances that you find yourself in.
Recognizing what's there.
Yes, luck is, we should see it not as a negative, but as something that's positive.
You talk about the importance of finding a tribe, which is different from finding sort of a group of people. Can you talk about what that tribe needs to be and how we can surround ourselves with similarly passionate people?
Yes, I think having connections with other people who share our passions is very important. You see it most obviously in group activities like music. I mean, for example, one of the stories I tell in the book is one of the people I interviewed in the book was Paul McCartney. You know, he was from, you may remember, the Beatles were also from Liverpool. And I was asking him if he enjoyed music at school in the 50s and 60s, and he said he really didn't. He said he went through the whole of his education at this particular school, and they had music lessons regularly. He said, but nobody ever thought he had any musical talent. This is Paul McCartney, by the way. One of the other kids in the same music program was George Harrison, the lead guitarist of the Beatles, and nobody thought he had any talent either. So this one music teacher had half the Beatles in his class, you know, and kind of overlooked it. Now, my point about this is that human talent is often buried deep. It's not lying around on the surface very often. Until circumstances encouraged it to surface, you may not even know you've got it. And that's one of the things the book is really arguing, that many people have hidden talents and don't even know. And connecting with other people who share your passion once you discover it is a way of evolving them.
We will continue our conversation with Dr. Ken Robinson after this break. He's a specialist in the development of human potential. His newest book is called The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Ken Robinson. He is a specialist in the development of human potential. His newest book is called The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. In finding those talents that, like Harrison and McCartney, may be somewhat hidden, although I have to imagine that that music teacher feels like an idiot today, you say it's important to challenge the things that we take for granted in ourselves. And you have this great story about a little boy named Bart.
Yes. Bart Connor is, I think, a wonderful man. He lives in Norman, Oklahoma these days. When he was about six, he lived at that time in Morton Grove, Illinois. When he was six, he discovered something rather odd, that he could walk on his hands as easily as he could walk on his feet. I don't know quite how this happened, but he tripped over one day and probably just started to do it. And as he said, you know, it wasn't much use, but it was very entertaining socially. And he was always being asked to do it. I think, you know, whenever the conversation lulled at family parties, people asked him to get back on his hands. But then he found he could walk up and down stairs doing it as well, just as easily. And as he said, he didn't know where this was leading him, but he just enjoyed it. His mother, though, obviously had an intuition about this, because when he was 10, she took him along to a local gymnasium. And he said when he walked into this gymnasium, he just thought it was totally intoxicating. It was like a mixture of Disneyland and Santa's Grotto, you know, the ropes, the vaults, the trapezes. Now, this is interesting about aptitude, Chris, you see, because when I walk into a gymnasium, I don't feel intoxicating. You know, I need to get intoxicated when I walk into the gymnasium. I need a drink immediately. But he loved it, and he started going regularly. And 10 years later, at the age of 18, he walked onto the mat at the Montreal Olympics representing America in the male gymnastics squad. And he remains the most decorated male gymnast in American history. Many of the listeners may know him as a commentator on sports. He now lives in Norman, Oklahoma. He's married to Nadia Comaneci, the first perfect 10 in women's gymnastics. They have this extraordinary gymnastics school, and he and Nadia are leading figures in the World Special Olympics movement. Now, I think it's a wonderful story of achievement for him, but what really interests me about it, too, is the fact that his mother saw not the whole of his life in front of him, but something that mattered to him there and then. You know, I mean, it wasn't as if she thought, well, hang on, Bart can walk on his hands, you know, when he was six. You know, I understand there's this girl in Romania. You know, if we kind of put all this together, you never quite know how it's going to work out. You know, you can't plan in a linear way. All you can do is invest in the talent that you have now, because it will change your circumstances. And Bart's life has been transformed by that, and incidentally, the lives of tens of thousands of other people.
Well, there's also this idea, you know, there are performance talents that at some point sort of out themselves, and yet we don't necessarily think of it as a brilliant talent. You can't do party tricks if you're good at reading people or at helping others. I wonder about what you say to talents that may not fit on that list of sort of performance skills that people like to say they have when they think about their own talents.
Well, you know, the book isn't only about writers and musicians and athletes, so although we certainly have those in, we have also a number of stories about scientists, mathematicians, technologists. A big theme here, you know, is the whole idea of creativity, of doing original things that are important. And the point about being in your element is it's very different for different people. One of the people I talk about in the book is Terence Tao, who's now recognized to be one of the preeminent mathematicians in the world. He's often said to be the Mozart of math. He had the Field Medal for Mathematics, which is the equivalent of the Nobel Prize in maths, in his early 30s. He found from a very early age that he loved mathematics. I mean, at the age of, you know, as an infant, you know, when he was three, he was doing mathematical calculations. Now, this is a very private thing to be doing. You know, there's nothing spectacular from the outside. And that the point you make is important, because very often individual talents may not be noticed from the outside. You know, there may be a passion for words or literature or reading or for connecting with other people. It's not all about performing in the usual sense of it.
We have an email from Eric in Arlington who says, I've been passionate about writing for more than 25 years, but was scared of the potential poverty of pursuing that. I went into the traditional job market and found a niche that I like but don't love. Now I have a family and kids to support. What kind of strategy should I pursue to transition into writing full-time about the kinds of things that I'm truly interested in?
It's a great question. You know, The one of the chapters in the book is called For Love or Money. And what I'm most keen to emphasize is that it isn't essential to enrich your life by doing the thing that you love, that you do it for a living. Some people prefer to run their passion alongside their day job, so to speak. I have a number of people in the book who do that exactly, who are, you know, are musicians or even scientists or amateur archaeologists, who actually feel that if they were to try and do this for a living, it might, in a way, get in the way of the pleasure they take in the doing of it. So how you, if somebody is interested to transition into a full-time career, then my advice is take it very seriously. You know, see if you can get some of your work published. See if you can find an agent. Focus hard on the writing that you'd like to do and make real time for doing it. Because obviously if you have a family and bills and responsibilities, you have to take care of that too. It may be, though, that you'd be just as happy, in some cases even happier, to do this alongside. But what I always urge people is to find that time, because it's always easy to make an excuse not to do something. It's much easier to do that, you know, and to say, well, conditions conspired against me. In my experience, it's very important for all of us to find some time for ourselves in our lives where we do either pursue the passion we know we have or we continue to look for it in ourselves.
You write in the book about talking to a friend of your brother's who's a keyboard player and saying to him, I would love to be able to play like you. And he said, no, you wouldn't.
No. It was a real slap down. It was years ago in Liverpool. My brother was in a band, and I went along to see him play, and he had this amazing keyboards player called Charles. And I was kind of hypnotized by how good this guy was. And at the end of the show, we were having a drink, and you're right, I said to him, you were great there tonight, Charles. He said, well, thanks. I said, I'd love to do that. Just like a casual social comment, And he said, no, you wouldn't. I wasn't expecting a debate, I thought he was going to accept this graciously. And he said, no, you wouldn't. I said, I would. And we went on in this way for some time, And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, if you would love to do this, you'd be doing it. I said, go on. He said, I love this. And to be able to play like I play, I probably play 8 hours a day and I play every day. And I do it because I love it. I couldn't imagine doing anything else. He said, I think what you mean is you like the idea of doing this. And, it stayed with me in my early 20s. He's absolutely right. It's one thing to fill your life with wishful thinking. But when you look at people who really do pursue their passion, they go at it. They make time for it. They make it a priority. I don't mean they neglect the rest of their lives, but they decide it matters. And if they get pleasure from it, they want to keep doing it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Dr. Ken Robinson. His new book is called The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. Let's speak to Steve in Fort Worth. Hi, Steve.
Hi. It's a very interesting conversation and a very interesting topic. I have observed people who are passionate about the things that they pursue. They take the time to do them, but they're not very good at it. And I've also had occasion to run into people who have extraordinary skills in a particular direction, but are not passionate in that. And I wondered if, in writing the book, you came across those kinds of things and what you might have to say about it. I'll take the answer off air.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. The first book one of the first books, truthfully, that I was involved in was called The Arts in Schools. And we had a brilliant editor on the book called Millicent, in her late 30s, I think she was then. And I asked her one day over lunch how she got to be an editor. And she said that she had spent most of her adult life as a concert pianist. And here she was now, sitting in this small room editing books. And I said, well, what happened? And what she told me was that she'd been a concert pianist for over 10 years. She'd been given a series of concerts a few years before in London and in Europe. And at the end of one performance, she went for dinner with the conductor, and the conductor said that how good she'd been. And she thanked him, and he said, but you didn't enjoy it, did you, Millicent? And she said, how do you mean? He said, well, you didn't seem to enjoy playing, although you were very good. And she said, well, no, not really. I didn't know. He said, do you enjoy playing? And she said, no, not really. I suppose I don't. He said, so why do you do it? And she said, well, I suppose because I'm good at it. And what became clear, she said to her, was that she'd spent her whole life under the expectation of other people that she would be a pianist because she had a talent as a child. Her parents were musicians. She'd practiced relentlessly. She'd gone to music college, done a Doctor of Music degree, and graduated into a concert career. She said, but nobody stopped to ask me, and I didn't stop to ask myself, if I wanted to do it. It was just expected because I was so good at it. And she said, at the end of that season, I closed the piano lid, and I've never opened it again because I realized, as a result of that conversation, that my whole life I'd been passionate about books, and I really wanted to write and to work with writers. And that's what she does. She said, I earn less money than I did before, but I've never been happier. So I think you're completely right about this, Steve. Sometimes people do things because they're good at it, but often underneath they may be nursing the sense that it's not the right thing for them. I think when you say there are people who are passionate about things they may not be very good at, I'd back the passion. You know, I mean, in the end, we all have to make judgments about the quality of what we do, and sometimes people who are passionate about what they do improve constantly because of the skill and the drive and confidence they bring to it.
I wonder, Ken, if you've observed that a terrible economy like the one that we're all struggling through right now around the world is, in some ways, people are afraid to leave what is at least a steady paycheck. And on the other hand, I wonder if people have an opportunity to be sort of liberated from what they didn't like very much in the first place.
I think that's exactly right, Chris. I mean, there is a bigger story in this book. Part of the story, the fundamental piece of it, is that, you know, we owe it to ourselves and to the people we love and who love us to, you know, have lives with purpose and meaning. And that's different from all of us, for all of us. You know, we all have very different talents and different abilities. We live in different circumstances. But we all have an opportunity to discover something that will make us feel that we're doing what we're meant to do. So it's a very personal story from that point of view, and the book is full of those stories. But as I say, I think, in the introduction, this book isn't about those people. It's about everybody else. And there is a bigger argument here, which is that we are living now in very, very uncertain times, times almost of revolution. I think it is revolutionary. You know, the world is being transformed by the effects of new technology. Our children live in a totally different world to the one that we grew up in. It's being transformed by the effects of communications and population changes around the world. And in these times especially, the need to use all the talents available in our communities and in the country has never been more important. It's important for economic reasons, it's important for cultural reasons, as well as for personal reasons. I do a lot of work with governments around the world on issues of innovation and creativity. I wrote a major strategy in the UK before I came to live in America on how you would promote creativity and innovation systematically in schools. And a big concern of mine is that children have immense capacities for creativity and innovation, and we tend to crush them. But in times when the old models are not working anymore, when the old systems are starting to break down, there was never a stronger argument for looking at ways of thinking differently and making better use of our talents. I think this is not a luxury argument. This is a bottom line argument for hard times.
Dr. Ken Robinson is my guest. He will be speaking at Arts and Letters Live on January 20th. You can find information about that appearance at dallasmuseumofart.org. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Sarah in Bedford. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Wonderful. Well, listen, I first have to say I appreciate this dialogue that you guys are having, and it's surprisingly actually following my train of thought. Has led me to call is actually a question about having multitudes of passions or interests. What advice would you have to someone who, say, has a multitude of passions? How do you focus on one particular passion or interest without neglecting others that you might have? And I'll just take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Sarah.
I wonder, Sarah, if you have anybody in particular in mind here.
Let's assume that she's lucky enough to have multiple passions.
Let's assume that. But I think if you've got multiple passions, that's terrific. I don't honestly think that you can have an embarrassment of talents in this way. I think it's a call you can only make personally. Often I find among people who have lots of passions, there may be something that's dominant for the time being. You know, I know musicians who are passionate about painting and about writing. I know many scientists who are passionate about playing the piano and singing. I think that's all part of having a rich and balanced life. I don't think anybody's ever rationed talent. And if you find you can pursue these in parallel, or if you find you have to make some choices, I don't think there's a moral principle at stake here. I think that's a question of how you decide you want to best organize your own life.
Do you think we do a poor job, maybe in our education system or in our culture as a whole, in communicating the fact that very often the most talented people also have to work hard at developing their God-given gifts?
I think we do, Chris, yes. So I do a lot of work around ideas of creativity, and I think it's often misunderstood that to achieve at your highest levels, to be most fulfilled in what you do, isn't just casting around yourself in a casual way. All the people I know who pursue something seriously work hard at it. They may not think of it as work, you know, but if you want to achieve something in music, there's a lot involved in terms of mastering the skills. But of course, if you enjoy it, if you're passionate about it, it's not work in the old sense of a grind, you know. My wife, for example, she had to go and learn the piano every day, you know, as a child, and she never liked it. And one of the reasons was the piano was facing the wall and she had her back to the teacher. Her passion is for dance and for design. She's a very gregarious person. So for a kid like that, you know, this wasn't a good thing to do. I was talking to somebody recently about this, and they said, you know, but I'm determined my daughter is going to, you know, become really skilled playing the piano. And
yeah, you hear that all the time from people. Yeah.
Yes, and, you know, this girl was 12, and I said, well, why is that so important? She said, well, because I think it's important that kids learn to stick with things. I said, so do I. I said, but does she like the piano? She said, no, she hates it. I force her to do it. I said, well, why are you doing that? I mean, there are hundreds of other instruments she could be learning that she might love, but she might be forcing herself from your conversation to go and practice the thing. You know, do you know what I mean? Finding your element means finding the thing that you love to do. And it really worries me if we force kids against their will when it's clearly against the grain because we have some Puritan work ethic that we're often misplacing their effort. If you get people in touch with things they love to do, they'll do the work for you.
Dr. Ken Robinson's book is called The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. He will be appearing at Arts and Letters Live in Dallas on January 20th. You can find information about that and about attending the event at dallasmuseumofart.org. If you want to join our conversation, you can get on the line now, 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the book The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. And my guest is Dr. Ken Robinson. And I should also say, he didn't ask us to say this, but I want to because I don't get to talk to people who have been knighted very often. He is also Sir Ken Robinson. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You talk a lot about the role of mentors in this whole process. What should we look for a mentor to help us do?
Well, I find, Chris, that very often people take their own natural abilities for granted, you know, in the sense that you think, well, if I can do it, there can't be anything very special about this. I mean, I imagine everybody's good at this. I see this all the time. You know, people are just naturally good at maths. They think, well, isn't everybody? I remember actually, I don't mean to go on about it, but I remember I didn't get this when I spoke to him, but I remember years ago reading an interview with Paul McCartney where he said he woke up every day with tunes in his head. And he was surprised that other people didn't, you know, because you only know your own experience in a way from the inside. And so it often because I think we take our own talents for granted early on, we don't think much of them. We don't necessarily think a great deal of them or that we can do much with them. So I found it's often the case with people that there has been somebody else there who may have spotted, like Bart Connor's mother did. You know, another parent might have said to Bart, you know, enough with the handstands.
Off the couch, right.
Yeah, well, you get off the couch, Bart. You know, we're trying to keep the place straight and do your homework. But she, in a way, looked into his eyes and saw who he was. And she couldn't see who he would become, but that this was something about him that was worth encouraging and nurturing properly. And I find it time and again. Sometimes it's a parent. It might be a friend. It might be a teacher. Often it's a teacher. But somebody who encourages a talent, sees it, helps to give you some confidence, And mentors may often go a good bit further than that and practically open doors for you. So I think it's a very important role to recognize in other people. And I think it's very important for parents and teachers and friends to recognize the importance of themselves of being mentors.
On the other hand, there are a lot of really well-meaning organizations that decide they are going to start a mentoring program. And although everybody tries to do their very best, it's so artificial that it ends up being almost useless. It's sort of just an exercise in showing up once a week or once a month. Is there something that you recommend to the companies that you consult with in order to make their mentoring programs really effective as opposed to just sort of lip service?
Yeah. Yes, I know what you mean. I worked in universities for 12 years in the UK. We had appraisal programs. And these things very often become rituals, rather than anything that's purposeful. It's why I think it's often as valuable for people close to you to take on that role, because it's about caring. I don't think it's necessarily a matter of the systems being faulty. It's the energy that people bring to them. You mentioned my own time at school. One of the key people in my life was when I was nine. I was at this special school in England. And a guy came into the room one day who was clearly official, and he chatted to me for a while, went away, and a day or two later, I was taken to the principal's office, and this man was sitting there. And I was given a whole series of tests to do. And because of that, I was moved up several classes, and I took a public exam, which helped me transfer from the special school into the mainstream education system, which is where I began the journey I'm still on. This particular man turned out to be a school inspector for special needs education, a wonderful man called Charles Stratford, who had a formal role to inspect the quality of education in the schools, but a personal passion for helping people develop. And clearly, in talking to me, this little sort of 7-8-year-old kid, I think I was probably 9 then, at the back of the class, he saw something that other people hadn't quite seen at that point. And because of him, I started to move in a very different direction. I often wonder what would have happened in my life had he not walked into the classroom. So I think it's about taking the role seriously and not taking it on as a ritual. And I think you're perfectly right. Sometimes these larger schemes can become a bit ritualistic.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Janet in Arlington. Hello, Janet.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
I just wanted to commend you on the book and your information. My passion is to help people find their passion in life as a life coach. And
wonderful.
The workshop I'm facilitating right now is an 8-week program. A lot of the energy that we put into it is that they need to even know that they have a dream.
Yes.
And we spend a lot of time and energy just trying to break the old stuff down so that they can even connect with the fact that they are worthy enough to embrace that passion.
Yes.
Yeah. So yes. I just wanted to commend you on your work and say thank you. We need a lot more of you out there.
Well, thank you, Janet. Let me commend you on yours. I think professional mentoring and coaching programs, properly thought through and properly conducted, have a huge role to play in helping people. And not just people in school, clearly. One of the whole points of this is that it's not too late. Life isn't linear. It's not, you're not in a cul-de-sac. You can always go back and revisit and start again.
Let's go next to Corey in Fort Worth. Hi, Corey.
Hi. I have a question about the whole, recognizing within yourself. That's my question is, how do I recognize the potential that I have in order to, make it manifest better?
So where do you find your talent and as well as your passion?
Right, because I love playing ice hockey, and I'm a black guy, So, I love playing ice hockey, That's one of my passions, and I want to get so much better because the level that I'm playing at now is when I was younger and I was, 12. I was playing at the level I am now, but I kind of recessed because I didn't play for a while. But, I still love the game, and I've always loved the game, and I never stopped loving it, But I was wondering how I could get there. I'll take my question off the air or answer out there.
Thanks for your call. Any ideas, Ken?
Well, I find that very interesting, Corey, Corey begins by saying, how can I find what my passion is? Can you give me advice on how I might find it? And then he tells you what it is, that it's ice hockey. And I'm sure, Corey, that's not the only passion and talent you've got. But if this is something that's there, to me, it's a very interesting example. People often say, I don't know what it is, really. but it's ice hockey. I think recognizing that and owning that as an idea about yourself is important. And secondly, if you reach this level when you were 12, then you know you should stay with the game somehow. I mean, I know in sports, you know, there may come a point. I say it somewhere in the book, you know, that there are obviously limits, practical limits to ambition. You know, I mean, I think if somebody decided they wanted to win the 100 meters at the Olympics and they're now 82, frankly, you know, I would recommend that you revise your plan. It's not impossible. I don't say it's impossible. A few things are. You know, I don't think I'm going to get the lead part in Swan Lake anytime soon. But I do personally have a passion for ballet. I love ballet. I used to be on the board of the Royal Ballet. And so whether as a player, I mean, I think if you're still active, Corey, and you want to play, then you should continue to play and create those opportunities so you can play at your highest personal level. And you should try and figure out what's stopping you doing that. Is it you or is it circumstances? But in addition to that, being in the world that you love is also important. To come back to the question you asked earlier, Chris, about finding your tribe, a lot of this is about being among the people who share your passion. Finding people who have the same energy for the thing that you're talking about. You may not disagree with them. You may not agree with them. You may not feel you're aligned at every point. But being around people who understand why you're so excited about this thing is very, very important. A lot of the creative energy in the world is driven by people making those sorts of connections. So whether as a player or as a writer in this area or as a commentator, this is what Bart Connor did, by the way, when he stopped performing. He graduated to being a commentator and an activist in the field of gymnastics. There are always more roles you can take on around this thing.
You do draw a really important distinction, though, and I think it's a good one to make, which is that being among your tribe is not the same as simply being a fan, where
yes.
You're basically sort of, you call it basking in the reflected glory of someone else's achievement.
Yes. Yeah, I think there's a big difference here between finding your tribe, so to speak, and just being a fan. It's a subtle argument, you know, but there's, if you're, if I can just go back quickly to the example of the Beatles, just because we started with it. You have to, I mean, I sometimes think, you know, what would have happened to those four guys if they hadn't met each other? You know, how much would we have heard of them individually? I don't know. But would they have had individually the impact the four of them had together? Probably not. I think it's a reasonable assumption. I've done a lot of work with John Cleese from Monty Python, you know, and you think, well, what would those five people have done if they hadn't met? What you find with great groups, you know, I think we have a whole section of the book about Miles Davis's album, Kind of Blue. When you get people who share the same creative interests, extraordinary things can happen. They raise their own game, and they find themselves in that relationship. I think there's a contrast between that, if you think of it, and people turning up as a fan and being one of the 20,000 people in the stadium. That's a good thing to do. I'm not denigrating it at all. But often people get lost in crowds. You know, they become part of a crowd mentality. And I'm not talking about losing yourself. I'm talking about finding yourself. And I think that's a bit different.
And the other distinction that we should talk about is that between imagination and creativity. People
Yes.
often use those words interchangeably, but you do not.
No, I think imagination is fundamentally important. It's the only thing, in my opinion, that really distinguishes human intelligence from every other sort of intelligence on the planet. You know, the ability to bring to mind things that aren't here in front of us. I remember reading once, you know, if you take even a young child into the garden at night and point at the moon, the child will look at the moon. If you take your dog into the garden and point at the moon, the dog will look at your finger, you know, and wonder what's going on. You know, they're waiting to be fed. But human beings are born with this capacity to look outwards and to bring to mind things that aren't present, to conceive of the past, to configure the future. And that's fundamental to me, to every form of human achievement. It's what being in your element depends upon, imagining an alternative, looking at other possibilities. Creativity is a step on. I think creativity is putting that to work. It's a very practical process, whether it's in mathematics or science or building or design or running a family or cuisine, whatever it happens to be. Being creative is doing things in a very practical way. And very often, people who achieve the most creatively are in love with the materials they use. You know, musicians love the music. Mathematicians love the numbers. You know, dancers love to move. It's a very material thing about being alive as a human being. So imagination is the heart of it. And so I would say to everybody, you know, if you're interested in really pursuing your potential, exercise your imagination. You know, you wouldn't dream of being an athlete if you sat on the sofa all day long staring at the television. You can't really expect to make the most of your own potential if you don't stimulate it. Go out and do something else. If you've never been to a ballet performance, go and see one. You know, if you've never been to a sports match, go and sit and watch it. You know, if you don't read books, go and read some. Exercise your mind, you know, encourage your imagination to work, and you'll be amazed, I think, at what might result.
And you say the most common obstacle to getting into one's element for so many people is fear. What forms does that take?
Fear. I think all kinds of fear. One of the people in the book, I have a chapter called It's Not Too Late, is a wonderful woman who's become a very close friend of ours called Susan Jeffers. Susan Jeffers began writing quite late in her 40s. You'd have to read the chapter to get the full story, but Susan became interested in the whole area of fear, and she taught a course on it, and she wrote a book called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway, which has become a classic of self-help. It's sold, I think, 4 million copies worldwide. I think it's a marvelous book. But what she sets out there are, you know, the multiple reasons we give ourselves for not doing things. You know, I'll look bad, I'll fall on my face, people will laugh at me, people will think I've gone mad, you know, you know, people will disapprove. We find 1,000 ways a day to inhibit our own sense of ambition. And, you know, some ways inhibitions are good. You know, I'm quite glad people have some inhibitions. But in terms of developing our creative abilities and talents, I think the fear of failure is a big one, the fear of being embarrassed, the fear of it not working out. A lot of the inhibitions are internal to us, and they play off then the way other people think of us. So I think dealing with that is an important bit. And I love the title of Susan's book, which is Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway.
Yeah, so it's not like it goes away. You just have to sort of understand it and
move
on. I
think it never goes away. I think if you speak to people who perform a lot, actors, sportsmen, sportswomen, they always have an anxiety about whether they'll be able to do it again. This time, you see them limbering up. Anybody who takes their work seriously takes a few breaths before they do it.
And you say that it's never too late. I wonder if it also takes work to remain engaged in one's element.
If it takes what, I'm sorry?
Now I have left you 10 seconds to answer this. But in order to stay engaged in one's element, that also takes some effort.
Well, I think if you're genuinely being inspired and enthused by it, then it's not an effort in the sense that it's a drag. You know, it's something that you get energy from it.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that's always the case. Things take it from you or they give it to you. And you know you're in your element when you get energy from the thing that you do.
My guest is Dr. Ken Robinson. His book is called The Element, How Finding Your Passion Changes Everything. He will appear at Arts and Letters Live on January 20th. You can find information about that on the Think page of KERA.org. Ken, it has been such a great hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
It's a great pleasure, Chris. Thank you so much for your question. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.